Why is there so much shame in our culture around aging?
I think it links directly to denial, which robs us of the chance to live a great life, and we shame away about half of it.
Hello, and welcome to The Right Question, a radio program and podcast featuring authors from the Western United States. Our funding comes from Humanities Montana and members of Montana Public Radio. I'm Sarah Aronson, speaking with Rita Summers Flanagan about her novel, Boomers, which reminds us it's never too late to really live. Your book is called Boomers, and it's a novel in the tale of eight baby boomers who are, as you write, cajoled into joining a loosely defined self-directed support group. And the book, to me, feels like a cross between the film The Bucket List and the show Grace and Frankie, and then some kind of reality TV intervention show support group. I want to know what compelled you to write the book and why write it as a novel?
Well, the subject matter is tough to deal with in any written form. I started thinking I could write a nonfiction, a little bit exploratory self-help kind of book, and I'll tell you what, the voice was horrible. I sounded like a really strict school marm shaking her finger at anyone who wasn't aging correctly.
Right.
So I was like, okay, that's not going to work. And then I ran into someone who told me about a woman named Jane Jacobs who had used the strategy of a fictional group that talked about complex issues, which may have been an unfortunate way to start because I struggled to get the book to lighten up. At first, it was pretty pedantic, but I worked on it a long time and finally, and the characters took over. And then I was able to go backwards and get that voice kind of weeded out. But I really, the reason for us to deal with this kind of material is I feel like we've glorified youth to the detriment of a lot of lived life.
I'm thinking about the liveliness of your characters. And I would just want to start with Millie. Can you just briefly describe Millie?
Millie is a rebel. And she is very Missoula. Everyone who's from Missoula will recognize she is a philosopher slash taxidermist. And she drives around in an old Toyota with antlers hanging out. And she fits in no world and every world politically. And she really has courage to face that she's aging. And she's really unhappy about it, and unhappy to be a boomer, unhappy to be getting older, and really doesn't know what to do. So she is kind of the source of the idea to have this group, because when her husband came out as gay, she went to a support group and found it really helpful. She's not a natural groupie, but that was her idea. So, yeah.
And the group begins at Patty and Dave's house.
Yes.
And Dave is a character, and I'm just wanting, because Millie and Dave have conflict. Dave has conflict with everyone.
Mm-hmm.
But tell me about the necessity of writing Dave as a character, and also just describe this man.
Dave. Dave taught at high school not far down the road from here, and he was modeled after some characters there that I got to know. He's a journalism teacher who also coaches football, and he is the token Republican, and he is he's the guy who really needs to push back on pretty much everything. And he, at certain points in the life, I'm sure he had a drinking problem, but he kind of had it under control, and he likes it when Patty gets a little tipsy, and, you know, they have those dynamics. But Dave's mom develops Alzheimer's, and the family was not ready for that. I mean, who is? But they really weren't. They hadn't done their homework. And he has this rich brother who's able to house their mom for a while, but then things turn around. And he is so brokenhearted and so frightened and doesn't know what to do. But he's frightened both about his relationship with his mom, but he's frightened that he, too, will get Alzheimer's. And it's haunting him.
Right. And what is his go-to strategy for dealing with these fears?
See who he can get upset, see what rude thing he can say, cause everyone to be uncomfortable so they're not looking at him. And then, you know, in the death warmed over party, he just plows into it and gets really drunk and talks about getting demented. And
can you describe that scene of the death warmed over party?
Well, it's a party. Uh-huh. It's a costume party they come up with. And it's partly because George has had a little accident and they're all acutely aware of their mortality and their frailties. And
just George is another character.
George is another character, mm-hmm. Yeah. He's the next door neighbor. And he fell off his ladder trying to rake his leaves out of his tree. He's a bit of a yard perfectionist. Mm-hmm. So they decide to have this death warmed over party. And the theme is that. And they're supposed to come dressed as something to do with death or the way they're approaching death. And they really have a ball with it. And they use it. Their newest member, Cooper, who works at hospice, has an agenda to make everyone get advanced directives. And Patty is super delighted when Dave actually kind of takes it seriously. So it's got a little agenda, but they mostly have a great time at the party.
And your sense of humor as a writer, I mean, just comes through. How did you find a way to navigate these serious topics, things like Alzheimer's and death and falling off of ladders with really funny moments?
I don't know. I give my credit to the characters because I think they're hilarious, but they're also very dear to me, of course. And they just take these weird twists and turns themselves. I know it's me and the muse in some embodied interaction, but when I finally figured out to let them be who they were, the book just became really fun. But also I could feel what was coming, that the tough stuff and the tragedies. And there are still parts of the book that when I even read them, I start crying. So that Space Needle scene just, I don't know why, but I feel very touched by that.
Mm-hmm. And I'll just say the Space Needle scene is a bucket list scene. I want to know which character resonates most closely with you as a person.
No, I want to know that about you. No, you're too young
my
to answer
future
that.
Self.
Right. You know, I've asked my friends who've read the book, which one do you think is me? And they take different guesses. I hope I'm a combination of George, who's just quirky as all get out and kind of oblivious. And I have a lot of the same quirks that George has, pulling down one eye and looking kind of bizarre. But Rachel is kind of what I'm about. Rachel, she is a cause-driven person who notices, and as a feminist, I totally notice this too, that she's disappearing. Older women disappear. Mm-hmm. We lose our voice. We lose our physical presence in the world. And it's tough going. But Rachel is probably the closest because I often fantasize gutting my entire wardrobe and all of my possessions and getting rid of the trappings of what we think of as respectable 60-something people and just going out there and saving someone, something, doing something that has meaning, because we can get so caught up, you know, getting dressed for the interview. I'm not even going to be visible, and I'm...
You have a beautiful scarf and earrings and matching vest.
Thank you.
Right?
Yeah, yeah. But it kind of illustrates, I think at age 65, we could get past some of this, and Rachel does. She gallops past it.
This makes me think of this point in the book towards the end where the characters talk about a calling, and one of the boomers asks, can you miss your life calling? And you respond through a different character. Of course, most of us do. but it never stops nudging. And so I hear this little nudging in you about causes and wanting to go save something, Rita. Mm-hmm. And I, two things. What was a calling that nudged you that you ignored or followed? And what's a calling that you have now?
I think we all have callings, plural. And the old term for that in the Catholic faith, I think, was vocation. And it was a profound sort of wonderment if you were supposed to dedicate your life to God in some form directly. But out of that has flowed a sense of being human means we want to have meaning in our life. So my calling, it's funny because people have said, what? You're writing fiction? So I've put my calling sort of on what I thought of as a back burner while I did my hamburger flipping job of teaching college. Sorry, college people. I don't mean your hamburger flippers necessarily, but it wasn't my calling. I was okay at it, but I love words. I love writing. I love letting words coalesce into an idea. And then I believe in the power of that. So now I think my calling is to continue to write. I don't know if fiction is the venue or poetry, or I have a blog, or, you know, things, ways to say to the world, it's okay. You're going to be okay. But you also really need to listen to who you are and what the world needs, because it is screaming need out there.
Mm-hmm. One of your central characters, Chris, comes down with cancer, stage 4 pancreatic cancer. And I was hoping that you would just read a brief passage from her perspective, Rita.
Sure. Chris thought about rain. You can lie on your back and watch the clouds roll in, wondering if it might rain. But once the rain hits and the sheets of water fall, there's no point in denying it. Chris had always liked the rain. She didn't like this new sense of life with a definite, almost visible end. But still, she had an inkling that perhaps, in time, she could accept it. Sure, there were plenty of places to hide, but Chris had tried hiding from things in her life. It hadn't worked out very well. It's better to get wet, better to welcome the rain, even if it's a vicious downpour, a deluge, a deadly flood.
What do you mean by it's better to welcome the rain?
That is probably the core tenet of the book. It's better to look in the mirror and say, hi, you, rather than look in the mirror and say, oh no, I got a little more gray hair. Oh no, there's a wrinkle. Oh no. If I was just a little thinner, or a little fatter, a little, it's just welcoming life. And sometimes life comes in the form of unwelcome or difficult circumstances made no better by hiding.
Thinking of hiding, one of the things that shocked me about the book is there are these moments of tension and release. And I noticed that as an author, I'd be curious to know if you're conscious of this or not, is when people seem to let loose a little, you know, when they get a little bit feisty or fiery, or when they speak off script, the book breaks open in a new way.
Yeah, I think that's the phenomenon I was talking about when I get out of the way and interact with the muse in a deeper place and get less afraid myself as a writer. That then it bubbles up and people say and do things that I hadn't really imagined. I suppose it's getting in touch with the unconscious. I don't know for sure. Writing is an amazing process.
If you're just joining us, you're listening to a conversation with Rita Summers Flanagan about her novel, Boomers. I'm Sarah Aronson. This is The Right Question. Our full conversation can be found online at mtpr.org, where you can also subscribe to our podcast and follow us on Facebook. I'm thinking about your work also as a therapist, and so I want to circle back around to that just in terms of your knowledge of group dynamics and human beings. But before that, I want to get really practical, because this book covers practical things like fiber for colon health and Medicare and caretaking of elders. And as you said, Alzheimer's and wrinkles and teeth whitening and breast implants maybe. So did you make a list of topics to cover about aging, or was it more organic?
It was a lived experience.
Yes.
Yes. No, I did not make a list. I let myself live into the lists around me. My friends, we all get together and complain and whine. And in those dark moments of your own soul, you know what you're afraid of, and you know that you really need to grapple with, like you said, the practicalities, advanced directives, Medicare rules, learning really about estate planning, stuff none of us want to do because it links to mortality and it's not fun. But we have to. It makes life so much better.
I was hoping you'd read another passage.
Okay, so as you know, Chris is the character who has stage 4 pancreatic cancer, and it's very sudden news, and the group has to grapple with that in their own ways, and Chris, of course, has to as well. Gabby is this wonderful woman I would love to just cuddle with. She's big and soft, and she's the group blurter. She's the group conscience. And she's unafraid. She's just unafraid to say what needs to be said and doesn't have many filters. So she is who is able in this passage that I'll read to kind of step into that painful silence and do something that opens the pain up for Chris. And I've rewritten this some because when I first wrote it, I did not have personal experience with some of these mortality threats. And so this holds very true for me now. I'm not sure I can read it without crying myself, but I will try. As Chris wept with Gabby, something unwound inside her. The tears washed away the shock and confusion. She came back into her body and mind. It was good to be home. She wasn't so afraid. She could face this new challenge like she'd faced so many others. She and Gabby took a single deep breath together and disentangled themselves. Gabby looked straight into Chris's eyes and managed a small, wet smile as she gave Chris one last pat and sat back down. Millie watched the fighting, the crying, the grief, and the denial careening around the room. Somehow, this tender, spontaneous embrace managed to break through it all. She was astonished by the depth of Gabby's ability to connect. In fact, the entire group astonished her right then. Sure, they'd caused her anger and disappointment, but also joy and amusement. And now the group offered comfort in the face of threat and pain. These relationships wielded great power. She didn't blame Cooper for being afraid, but she missed him. His retreat had gutted the content of her daydreams and had filled many of her nights with despair. But the group needed her, and she needed it. Her loss seemed insignificant now as she and the others prepared to walk the road ahead with Chris.
What is it about the power of relationships?
We are social beings. We do not survive without relationships. You know that babies are touched or cuddled, don't thrive. We are meant to be in relationship. in community. We function as organisms within that community. And the person who thinks they're alone isn't really alone because we're layered with the existence of other human beings. But the more we sort of get into community and group relationships, the more our edges start to come out, and they need to be smoothed. We become better people in that process, but it's not always really fun.
I think the book does a nice job of highlighting that and uses that metaphor, in fact. Rita, is it realistic to think that boomers could fashion a group based off of your book and reimagine?
I hope so. In some form, if I write a sequel, which I've sort of started on, I think the plan is for all hell to break loose at Boomerville, because it will. And it's you can't idealize the efforts to do this. But if people look online at all, they'll find all sorts of elder communities coming into being. And this is just one model that I thought was realistic for Missoula. It's a Missoula.
Will you just describe Boomerville?
Well, after Chris has died, it felt like for me as an author, it wasn't quite over. It was a painful part of the book for me. And I struggled for a while, like, okay, team, where's this supposed to go now? And Chris had left some hints about that and knew where the struggles and the pain was. But George, of course, in his kind of zany rejuvenation as a 70-something guy, decides to come up with a plan for building a sort of condo concept with shared space and all of the values, or most of the values, tucked in that the members shared. But of course, chickens and George and his gardening, and he has some gardening secrets that he'll have to keep hidden. And then Rachel is all about passive solar and energy use. And so Boomerville is the group plus some people they add in who have agreed to co-invest in a pretty cool multiple dwelling.
So I want to circle back around to your other roles in life. And I'm also a therapist. And so in reading this book, I was looking for the moments of group process and insight and was trying to figure out how intentional you were about flagging for the reader, this is an insight. This is a moment of development and growth. Look over here. And how you also tried to balance that with just writing fiction.
Well, I'm glad you recognize that the book tries really hard to explain and illustrate the power of group, because as you know, Sarah, there are not good insurance coverages for group work. We don't get a chance as mental health professionals to do the kinds of groups we could do, and they would be awesome. So I'm sorry that that's not the case, and I probably had a fairly overt agenda to make people realize the power of group. And it is a powerful way to interact. Originally, I was going to have Millie be a psychologist, which was a bad idea because she was a renegade. But the awareness of group process is threaded in to the characters, and they have backgrounds that gave them various exposures. But I wish there were ways for people to be in groups. But the other caution, and you could probably echo this, is groups are powerful. They're not inert substances. So it has to be approached with some respect and care. And early on, Gabby, who's been aware of AA type groups, says, well, what are the ground rules here? And they all kind of back off of that because they really don't know what to say, but they kind of acknowledge there probably needs to be something.
One of the threads that I smiled at was Victor Yalom blurbs your book, who is the son of a very famous existential psychiatrist, Irvin Yalom, who wrote the book on group therapy, the book. And he is also a novelist. And so I got thinking, and I'm also a writer, why do therapists need to write?
Not all therapists write.
No.
They have other ways to do creative work in the world. But think about this. We are the talking cure. We're the words. Mm-hmm. We know the power of words and being together in the room, in the defined context, with a relationship that matters a great deal, and with words. So it would be pretty normal for some subset to begin to wonder about other ways to do healing words or get that energy out there.
On your letterhead, you identify yourself as author, psychologist, poet, dreamer. What does it mean to be so authentic in your presentation of self? And what is your hope for others?
You know, I got there by crashing into a cancer that was rare and aggressive and scary, and other events in my life as well. But that one just completely changed the level of self-protectiveness I had lived with. I think retiring helped too, because after you retire, what can they do to you? Kind of, you have that attitude like, ugh. It is a little bit scary to be so exposed. And earlier I was telling you, I become more of an introvert, which is sort of weird because I am out trying to market things and have a voice in the world. But another part of me feels pretty shy and like, what right do I have? And I have a little side of me that's a little afraid of being so out there. But yeah, what fiction writer, what poet is not bleeding through those words? I mean, it's part of the craft. And if you're not, I think the work's probably not that good. So I am sort of happy to get to write those things about myself and a little intimidated. And I would say to other people, don't wait till you have some scary thing that you think you're going to die. Just take stock. You're not going to live that long, period. Mm-hmm. So enjoy it.
Rita Summers Flanagan is an award-winning professor, author, poet, artist, and rancher. She lives in Missoula, Montana. Look for more information about her and her work at mtpr.org, where you can also subscribe to our podcast and follow us on Facebook. Many thanks to Humanities Montana for supporting us since 2008. And thanks to you for listening. I'm Sarah Aronson, and this has been The Right Question.
The Right Question is produced by Sarah Aronson, Beth Ann Austin, studio engineer and production assistant. The music in this program was written and performed by John Floridis.